Welcome to Fresh Research, a podcast from the Nonprofit Times, where we explore some of the latest findings focused on the world of charities. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Mark Arivna, senior editor at the Nonprofit Times. Each episode of Fresh Research will examine two recent studies. We'll talk to the authors about what they found and why it's important to nonprofits. We'll also give away some books and highlight access to other valuable information from the Nonprofit Times. Where are America's volunteers? That's the question that Robert Grimm and Nathan Dietz set out to answer. They examined volunteer data over the past 15 years or so and came up with some not so great, albeit interesting findings. They join me in the first segment of this episode to discuss volunteer hotspots and some of the changes in volunteering since the early 2000s. The second segment of the program features Lyle Matthew Kahn. He's director of research and communications at Funders for LGBTQ Issues. Their recent study is called The Philanthropic Closet, LGBTQ People in Philanthropy. He'll discuss just how many LGBTQ folks work in the sector, but also whether that's accurate and why it's important to nonprofit employers. Welcome to this episode of Fresh Research. On today's program, we have Robert Grimm, director of the Do Good Institute at the University of Maryland's School of Public Policy. He's also the Levinson Family Chair in Philanthropy, along with Nathan Dietz, Associate Research Scholar, and their study is called Where Are America's Volunteers? Gentlemen, thanks for joining the program. I appreciate it.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you, Mark.
Let's get to the big question. Where are America's volunteers?
Well, I'll hit one of the, I think, really interesting points, and then I think Nathan could share a few others. I think one of the most interesting overall points is that in the last few years, we've experienced historic highs in the number of charitable dollars and actually number of volunteer hours that have been contributed to nonprofit organizations. But at the same time, we are actually experiencing a two-decade low in the percentage of Americans who actually volunteer or donate to charity. So we're actually experiencing historic highs in dollars and hours, at the same time experiencing somewhat historic lows in the percentage of Americans who give or volunteer in a year. And our research starts to look at how is that playing out, because these trends are actually quite widespread.
They are. Just to follow up on that, what we found, I think, through the looking at the data closely over the last 15 years or so, is that there's a big chunk of America's volunteer workforce and America's donor base that have always been there. The thing we noticed is that the size of both groups is declining over time, and it's declining in particular parts of the country, and not more so than in others.
There's no surprise that volunteering rates have been going down, because if I recall, the volunteer rates were somewhere near 30% in the early 2000s. And each year this kind of dropped off. The last report was, I believe, just under 25% a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So what was in your study that really jumped out at you?
So I think a couple of really interesting things is how widespread the results are. So, for example, we looked at all 50 states and over 200 metro areas, and 31 states in the last decade plus have experienced declines in volunteering, and not one state has experienced an increase in volunteering in that time. We also found it very interesting that areas that have been particularly rich in volunteers and people engaged in their community actually are experiencing the biggest significant declines. So you see it particularly declining in rural areas, particularly declining in the suburbs. And so those are two, I think, surprising findings for us, that, you know, there really is hardly any place in the country that's experiencing an increase in volunteering over the last couple decades. And places that have been kind of rich in their residents really engaged in their community are actually the areas that are experiencing the most significant declines. Mm-hmm. Nathan, you want to say something?
No, I think those are the two things that surprised me the most. The work that we showed in the brief here, I think, points out something that we kind of already knew intuitively and that we've seen in previous research, which is that the places where we saw among metropolitan areas, the places where we saw the biggest declines are in places where there's a lot of socioeconomic distress, fewer places to volunteer, and in places where there's just more barriers between neighbors. So that's more or less what we expected to find. But I think Bob pointed out the two surprising parts that we didn't anticipate.
And I would add to Nathan's point. I mean, I think It's not a surprise, but it is, I think, a real challenge. Communities that experience economic distress also often experience declines in volunteering and other kind of charitable behavior. So they kind of face a double whammy at the same time. When maybe the need is highest, often they're also experiencing less charitable behaviors. I think two other really interesting things, though, are that, you know, there's a lot of literature, and we even teach this, about being efficient. And sometimes people argue there's too many nonprofits. I'm starting to actually wonder if we don't have enough nonprofits, because you see a lot of communities where less people are engaged. It's also because they have a lot less nonprofits per capita. And so one of the things that we think I'm starting to come around to is I think we might need support for more nonprofit startups, for more, you know, community organizations. And the other thing that I think this data helps with is it allows you to look at what's going on in your community. By us looking at all 50 states and 200 cities, you can really find out what's the trends been like for the last two decades in your area, and also maybe identify what are some of the barriers. For example, as Nathan's saying, if you have a more mobile population, then you need to think even more about some creative solutions to engage those individuals in their community, because, you know, these communities are places where maybe there's less homeownership. People are moving in and out a lot. And so, you know, people feeling anchored and getting to know their neighbors is more of a challenge. And you can recognize that and think about strategies to try to address it.
Robert, I think you'd said that 31 states saw a decline in the volunteer rate and not one state saw an increase. You're talking about even places that are volunteer rich, places like Utah and Minnesota, that are always at the top of the list in terms of volunteering. It's still flat in those areas.
Exactly. Not a single state had a significant increase. And then I think the other thing to emphasize is that some of the places that we would mostly consider, you mentioned, you know, Minnesota, Utah, places that are really rich, many of these places are places that experienced the most decline. And so I think that those communities probably are feeling a sense of loss in those communities, because they can feel there's been a significant decline. So you want to say something else about that, Nathan?
Yeah, only that I think this is where it's really interesting to take a look at what happens below the state level, because there are, first of all, there are metropolitan areas, big ones, where we did see increases, like Las Vegas, Virginia Beach. Those are the two I can remember offhand.
So volunteering is up in Las Vegas.
Volunteering is up in Las Vegas. Yeah. I mean, like a lot in a lot of these cases, the volunteering rate was very, very low. So they had no place to go but up, but they did increase. And they're among the few places that did. The thing is, though, below the state level, like within Utah, I don't think we realized before this that different trends are taking place in places like Salt Lake City, Ogden, and Provo. I mean, you see increases, decreases, and flat volunteering rates among those three areas. And if you just look at Utah and say, well, we know why Utah has a high volunteering and giving rate, I think you missed part of the story.
Another example is we looked at Michigan as another state, and you can see that there are certain cities, Lansing is one of them, that had a very significant decline. And so you can actually see some cities have basically been kind of even, but you can see certain parts of the state are actually driving the reason why a state might be having a decline in volunteering. So that's one of the values, I think, of the data that we use. It's so large, it's really robust. It allows us to look at, you know, 200 plus metro areas. And so when you see not a single state has increased and you see 31 have declined, you can actually look under the hood in some ways, as Nathan's saying, and kind of see what metro areas are really driving that result.
And I think that's really important for local policymakers, because like Bob said, you know, this in the end, this comes down to individual people and what we can do to work more closely together, to encourage each other to volunteer. It's not a situation where we need help from Washington to figure out what the federal government should do. Local politicians, local leaders can figure out how to make a difference, how to help other people in their communities make differences.
So you mentioned, Nathan, you mentioned Las Vegas, and you went into some detail on Utah. What were some of the bright spots, either metro areas or certain regions, in terms of volunteer rates, and where were some of the big issues or drop-offs in volunteering?
Some of the biggest increases, I think, that we saw, and I'm looking at the list here, it's not a very long list, but there are places where I think seeing volunteering rates increase in places where it was really low is really heartening, because it gives everybody some hope that even though civic engagement might be historically low in certain places, there's always room to improve. Places like San Jose, Las Vegas, Virginia Beach, those are among the top 50 metropolitan areas in terms of population. So you saw big changes in the population centers in many states. The other thing I thought was encouraging, and it's kind of a glass half empty, glass half full proposition, but in America's biggest cities, you saw volunteering rates at least holding steady over this time period. The glass half empty side of that is that there weren't increases, although in New York, I think between the mid-2000s and the late 2000s, you did see a significant increase. You didn't see that in places like Chicago and Los Angeles. On the other hand, you didn't see decreases either. It's bad that we saw decreases in the suburban areas and the rural areas, but in America's biggest cities, I think there are signs that the civic infrastructure is hanging in there.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that surprised us that we didn't mention before is that rural and suburban have declined significantly over the last two decades. Yeah. But actually, the urban volunteer rate has been basically stable, which is very surprising because now urban, rural, and suburban volunteering are almost very close together. It used to be that rural and suburban volunteer rates were much higher than urban volunteer rates. But because urban stayed stable and rural and suburban have been declining, they're actually pretty close together now.
Yeah.
Millennials are always mentioned as being very socially conscious. They want jobs that also make a difference. They're not impacting the volunteer rates at all, even though they're the biggest generation, or will be soon, passing baby boomers. Is that a big bulge that's going to move through as they get older into those prime giving and prime volunteering ages, that they're not even impacting the volunteer rates yet?
Well, I think if they don't impact the volunteer rates, it's not for a lack of enthusiasm. It's not for a lack of interest in trying to help. I think the other side of the equation, this has always been the case, but organizations need to play their part in creating volunteer roles and opportunities, first of all, that people find attractive. Second of all, being more willing to take chances on younger volunteers as opposed to just older volunteers who have always been there, always been supportive. They've been the mainstays. The fact is, you know, the volunteer workforce always needs replenishing, always needs new blood and new ideas and new enthusiasm and energy. And organizations where people volunteer, I think, can do a lot to, should spend a lot of time trying to think about how to make sure that the new blood keeps coming in, the new people keep entering the workforce, and convincing them to stay, persuading them to keep on volunteering.
Yeah, I mean, two things I want to emphasize about what Nathan said. One is, I think we really underestimate what young people can achieve.
Yeah.
And we've seen that, as I mentioned, with these compelling organizations that students have created with the Duggan Institute. Yeah. But secondly, one of the things that's interesting about the millennial generation is some of the research we've also done outside of this report notices that their volunteer rates are somewhat lower than past generations. And I think there are some societal changes going on that make it harder for them maybe to engage in volunteering than in the past. And we maybe need to recognize that and try to address it. For example, people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, less likely now to buy a home, less likely to marry or marry later. When they have kids later, much more mobile, so less anchored to their community. And so these kind of societal changes that are happening, they affect how people engage in their community, because people who own a home, people who have kids, people who, the longer they live in the community, it increases the odds that they're actually going to become engaged in their community. You know, one of the things that Nathan and I have talked about in the past is people often think about volunteering as an issue about time. You know, but we did this study that looked at kind of how do people who volunteer and don't volunteer use their time. And we found that people who don't volunteer watch hundreds and hundreds of additional hours, of TV, you know. So, you know, one of the things that we argue, and I think it's great for your audience, is that you got to create volunteer opportunities that people want to make the time for.
Yes.
You know, you got to create compelling opportunities that take advantage of person's talents, you know, their passion, and really ask, like, what do they want to get out of the experience? You know, that's the way to kind of keep them engaged. And I think, you know, we've got some societal trends that are making it harder, even for millennials, I think, to be engaged in their community. So I think we need to recognize that. And then I think we also have to think about what are strategies we could do to try to address that and make them say, I definitely want to do about this kind of volunteering. I definitely want to be giving and volunteering with this organization, because it's, you know, it's something I'm gaining a lot from. It's using my skills well, and it's something I want to do on a regular basis, not, you know, a one-off activity.
So your report, your study looks at giving numbers from 2002 to 2015, shows a decline, a steady decline in the volunteer rate and in volunteering hours and all that, despite the increase in charitable giving, of course. But the new numbers from the Volunteering in America 2018 from the Corporation for National Community Service, their numbers for the new report, first one in 2 years, shows a huge increase in volunteer rates. Does that use the same data, and how does that jive with your longitudinal study of a decline and suddenly now a jump if you look at their study for the 1 year?
Yeah, we've been trying to figure that out too. I think we've, after spending a long time with the historical data that we used for this report, we've only had 2 weeks, I think, to try to ponder what might be happening with the new data that was released by the corporation. It is coming from the same source. It is from the current population survey. It was the data were collected in September 2017. I think that it's a different type of survey that was done between 2002 and 2015. It covers a lot more topics. It's the sample of households, I think, is more or less the same. It's not the same households anymore, but I think it was done the same way. That much we know. I think there are a lot of things that we don't know, I think, just because we haven't had a chance to get our hands on the data and really try to figure out what might be driving these numbers.
I think one of the things that we're hoping in the near future is to get at the data so that we can look at it, work with it, and see if there is a way for the data to be comparable with the data that we use in this report. As Nathan said, they did do some things differently than they had done in the past, but we're interested in seeing if we can get the data and see, is there a way to compare our historical data with this new data?
Yeah, because right now, if you take the numbers at face value, you're looking at an increase the size of which we've never seen in terms of looking at official government Census Bureau sponsored data collections. We've never seen an increase during any 2 year period that's this large.
Well, great. Thanks. Thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah. It's our pleasure.
That's Robert Grimm, director of the Do Good Institute at the University of Maryland, along with Nathan Dietz, associate research scholar. Their study is called Where Are America's Volunteers? Have you rated this podcast yet? Well, what are you waiting for? If you've enjoyed the show this year, please let us know what you think by rating us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. It can help other people find the show. You can also help your colleagues find the show by telling them about it. Share a link to the show with the hashtag FreshResearch, and you'll be entered to win a book from the NPT Library. Congratulations to last month's winner, PMA Consulting in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks for sharing, but also thanks for listening. Lyle, thanks so much for joining me for this episode. I appreciate it.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Lyle, tell me, the philanthropic closet, why is that important? How did it come about, the idea to survey folks in the nonprofit sector about their sexual orientation?
Sure. And that's a great question. And I think there's a long history, there's a long story there. At Funders for LGBTQ Issues, we had long been asked, how many LGBTQ people work in philanthropy? So in our organization, we have a wealth of data on foundation funding for LGBTQ communities, but we'd never been able to answer that question. There have been several attempts to answer that question by organizations like COF that does the Council on Foundations. I guess I should use the full names. It's not everyone's going to know these acronyms, but by Council on Foundations, they had done a long survey where they surveyed HR professionals and foundations and asked about sexual orientation and gender identity. And unfortunately, a lot of foundations didn't provide that data, so they were never able to report out on that. There was other groups that have done smaller surveys. Regional associations like Philanthropy New York had done this for foundations and nonprofits, but it was on a smaller scale, so we didn't know what it looked like nationally. And then there was groups like United Philanthropy Forum that surveyed philanthropy-serving organizations. But again, we didn't know what the demographics looked like on the foundation level. What does the composition of the staff and board look like, and how many LGBTQ people work there? So this was a long asked question that we never had an answer for. And thanks to generous funding from the Haas Junior Fund, and thanks to a partnership with SMU Data Arts, we were finally able to answer this question by asking people directly how they identified. And so we took the opportunity to, with this funding and with this partnership, to launch what is known as the Diversity Among Philanthropic Professionals Survey. And in this initial pilot survey, we were able to get 36 foundations to participate and 947 individuals to self-report on their not only their sexual orientation and gender identity, but on their age, on their roles, on their race and ethnicity, and on a wealth of data that we now have about the sector. This survey ended up having one of the highest response rates that SMU Data Arts has ever had at 34%, which means that we have a 99.9% confidence that this data is representative of the 36 foundations that participated.
So it sounds like this might be a baseline for future surveys. Maybe look at longitudinal, how these percentages may or may not change in the coming years.
I mean, I think that that's a big hope of ours. One of the big hopes is that we will actually move this, as we call it, the DAP, the Diversity Among Philanthropic Professionals Survey, that we will actually move this to a larger entity like Change Philanthropy, which is an association of the identity-based associations in philanthropy. So it includes groups like us, groups like the Association for Black Foundation Executives, Hispanics in Philanthropy, Native Americans in Philanthropy, the Women's Funding Network, Asian American and Pacific Islanders in Philanthropy, the Philanthropic Initiative for Racial Equity, National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy. I'm trying to spell out these acronyms, so I'm going a little slower than I normally would be able to. Neighborhood Funders Group, forgive me if I missed someone and they're hearing this and they're horribly offended. Our goal is to hopefully elevate that to this larger group and to expand the number of foundations that participate and hopefully do this on what we're thinking right now is maybe an every 2 year basis, an every other year basis. And so this is in some ways a baseline. You know, in some ways we weren't the natural fit to do this. We did this because we really needed to demonstrate that you can ask about sexual orientation and gender identity. You can do so and that people aren't offended, right? That people are more willing to answer a question about their sexual orientation and gender identity than they are about their income and other things that we found, right? And so we wanted to pilot that. We wanted to prove that. You know, one of the pushbacks that people that were doing this research in aggregate had gotten in the past was, why am I going to ask my staff about their sex lives, right? And this goes so much farther than their sex lives. This is an identity. This is something important. And if we don't have this data, we're really at a lack. And, you know, for me, it's really crushing that we know now that this question is not going to be asked in the 2020 census, as it was proposed during the Obama administration. And so we're still not going to have this question on a national level. And, you know, the top level findings are with this research, we know that there's a notable number of people working in philanthropy, and we know the majority of them are in the closet. And so if we extrapolate that, we know that people are in the closet. How likely are they in other surveys? For example, the best data we have on LGBTQ people in general is the Gallup poll that was conducted in partnership with the Williams Institute at UCLA Law. Each time they've done it, they've found more and more LGBTQ people. When they first did it, it was in the 3% rates. Now it's at 4.5% of adults in the United States. And it's not that there are more, all of a sudden we found more LGBT people, or that there are more LGBT people now. It's that people are more comfortable disclosing their sexual orientation and gender identity to a stranger over the phone for these Gallup surveys, right? So there's certainly, I think there is still a big closeted nature in that. I think when you have these private link surveys that are completely anonymous, where you're not talking to someone, you get a higher response rate. And I'm hopeful that we can do this data and that the field in general can start asking these important questions, because right now, you know, we're not going to have a baseline from the federal government.
Any idea how the philanthropic closet study compares with general population numbers?
And so as I was alluding to, you know, it's alarming because we don't have any federal numbers on this, right? We've never been counted in any census. We're not going to be counted in the 2020 census, regrettably, because of a decision by this administration. We have, the best data we have is the data from the Gallup, the people at Gallup and the Williams Institute at UCLA Law School. And that number has been increasing, I think, as more people feel comfortable telling people over a telephone call that they identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. And I still think it's a massive undercount. As I was saying briefly, you know, there are the best, and there's no nice way to say this, but the best comparison is the Google gay porn searches. And when you compare those, especially in states that have really low LGBT numbers, according to Gallup, like Mississippi or Alabama, you have a huge discrepancy. So again, you know, this is an identity. It's not based necessarily on behavior, but I think that that 4.5% that Gallup is saying now, which is almost a full percentage point higher than what they initially reported, is still a huge undercount. And so I think, you know, we might have slightly more people, slightly more LGBTQ people that work in philanthropy than we see in the population in general. But I don't know that it's that different, because we don't have, you know, I think there's a lot more LGBTQ people in the general population.
What can nonprofits do here from here on out? Because I think it's these HR executives who probably are most interested in running a tight ship and having employees be, you know, 100% to their potential and bringing, like you said, their whole selves to work.
Yeah. So what can, you know, as I said, we laid out five recommendations in the report. And, you know, briefly to summarize those, you know, the first one is take a look at your current non-discrimination policies, right? You likely have a non-discrimination policy that in hiring and in promotions, you know, protects people on the basis of race and ethnicity, on the basis of age, on the basis of gender. But double check that that includes sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression, so that you are covering LGBTQ people in that umbrella, right? And as you are thinking about hiring and promotions, you know, conduct some targeted outreach. I don't necessarily think that people do this maliciously, but I think all too often our pool of candidates is restricted to the networks and circles that we know. And if we really are serious about diversity, and we really are serious about bringing on some new and incorporating some new perspectives into our organizations, perspectives that we know undoubtedly will enrich our organizations, it is really, I think, key and wise and incumbent upon us to do some targeted outreach to those communities. So do some targeted outreach to the LGBTQ community. And there's a bunch of organizations that can help you with that. To that extent, we also recommend that you really look at your human resources policies and make sure that you have LGBTQ friendly and LGBTQ inclusive human resources policies. Again, there's a ton of literature on what that could look like, you know, both supporting LGBTQ parents, you know, making sure that your health insurance policies, for example, cover transgender related care. Those are just a few of the ways to do that, but there's a lot that you can do there and that you can gradually start to roll out and incorporate. The other thing is that we recommend that you treat LGBTQ discrimination the same way you treat any other kind of discrimination in the workplace. You know, you don't treat it as a laughing matter. You take it seriously, because I think that's another important thing. You know, you wouldn't, there's other kinds of discrimination that you would take drastic action on. And all too often, LGBTQ discrimination is kind of viewed as, oh, well, you shouldn't have done that, but okay. And that's an important thing that I think HR professionals can start elevating in their organization and making clear, you know, we're going to take this more seriously. And the last thing we recommend is that you provide trainings and foster a culture where ongoing learning and ongoing, you know, self-assessment and improvement around your own cultural competency is both encouraged and ultimately kind of expected. And we hope that you would do those trainings, but that those trainings wouldn't be the end of it, that they'd be the beginning. And I should mention, you know, any organization looking to improve their LGBTQ cultural competency that works in philanthropy should definitely look out at funders for LGBTQ issues as a resource. If you're working in other spaces, you know, if you are a company, there's a great organization called Out and Equal that works on LGBTQ workplace issues. And even if you're not a company, they have a lot of great resources. Today, they just came out with a guide on non-binary issues for companies. And certainly, you know, these can apply to nonprofits as well. And there are a range of other LGBTQ organizations out there willing to help you in this journey. And I think, you know, we all see this as an equity journey. Every organization has some ways that they could be better on equity. And so being, you know, gently self-critical, I think is key here, and finding space for improvement. And, you know, we're all on this journey together and we're here to help.
Lyle, thanks so much for your time today, joining us on this episode. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's another episode in the books. Thanks for listening, and special thanks to our guests for taking the time to join us. Don't forget, share the Fresh Research link on Twitter or Facebook to be eligible to win a book from the NPT Library. Use the hashtag Fresh Research or tweet us at Nonprofit Times. And if you like what you hear, please rate us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Arivna for the Nonprofit Times, and this has been Fresh Research, a podcast about some of the latest research in the philanthropic sector. Until next time, keep up with us at thenonprofittimes.com.